From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because life and truth matter. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast, we present an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast that we began on our previous broadcast. Hank is talking with historian Dr. Nicole Rokas, author of Time and Despondency, Regaining the Present in Faith and Life. Let's rejoin Hank and Dr. Nicole Rokas in their conversation.
What you point out in the book, I think, is very, very important. I'd love to have you elaborate on it for everybody listening in, and that is the idea of despondency as a crime that needs a punishment, or conversely, the idea of despondency as a sickness that is in need of healing. That theological distinction seems to me to be very, very significant in how you attack or how you even think about your problem and how you start to remedy it.
Yeah, I mean, one of the hard things that I sort of had to reckon with in this book is, you know, when it comes to describing mental patterns and thought patterns that are recognized as sins in the church, you know, despondency is technically described as a logismos, which is the Greek word for thought. And so in this kind of realm of theology, sin often begins as a thought. We have these kind of thoughts that come at us, and the more we start to listen to them, the more we start to cooperate with them, then we eventually act on them in sin. And so despondency is this whole progression. It's the progression from the thought of, I feel a certain way, I'm thinking despondent thoughts, all the way through to, okay, I'm going to stop praying, I'm going to stop going to church, I don't care anymore. That's the whole spectrum. And anytime we start talking about like mental patterns and sin, we get into this tricky territory of, well, does that mean things like sadness or depression could also be considered a sin? And so I think it's much more helpful to sort of side with this idea in orthodoxy. I mean, I find this particularly helpful is to remember that sin is a sickness. It's a sickness. It's not a crime. And, you know, we are always, as humans, trying to turn towards Christ for restoration and for healing. And so we don't have to, when we recognize despondency within us, you know, it's not that, oh, I'm despondent, I've maybe, you know, acted on this despondency, now God is angry with me and he's going to punish me. That's not really how it works. It's that when we become despondent or when we start sinning in any other way, we are turning inward toward our own self and inward on our own brokenness and our own emptiness. And therefore, are turning away from Christ and we're turning away from relationship with him. And that sickness is something that needs healing in the church, and it needs healing by turning back towards Christ. So the tragedy is not that, shoot, we've made God angry again. It's that, gosh, I've now fragmented myself from community with Christ.
Could it be a both and? Could it be both a sickness and a crime against the holiness of God?
Yeah, I think that that's definitely healthy. Like, I don't think that one should err on one side or the other. The reason why I tried to flesh this out a bit in my book is because I find that on a practical level, especially when it comes to the whole pattern of living that despondency tends to entrap people in, despondency itself can make people feel very ashamed and broken. And so then I think the most beneficial and healing thing to remember is that the door is always open to turn towards Christ. And I think that people are more willing to take that door when they recognize that this is a sickness rather than just a punitive crime.
Right, right. Despondency can arise from many different causes. One of them that you point out in the book is anger.
Yeah.
So we have an anger towards what is present, a desire with respect to what is not present.
Yeah, so I mean, like, you know, one example is in English, we have this sort of proverb, I guess. It's always greener on the other side of the street. And a lot of us, if we're not careful, can kind of live our lives by that mantra, is no matter what we have, it always seems better what other people have, and never feels like what God's given us is good enough. And that's kind of the anger that Evagrius was talking about. And you can imagine he's writing for a monastic community. These people have left their homes, they've left their family members, and they've retreated to an area of the desert that was pretty desolate and pretty hot a lot of the time. And in that kind of environment, you can start to see how anger, you know, might come pretty naturally. You begin to be angry at your surroundings, even if they're surroundings you chose on your own volition. And on the flip side, start to desire things like, well, I desire to go back to my family. I desire to go back to life in the world. And as I said before, you know, those just kind of cancel each other out until you don't really have any energy within you left to live the Christian life.
Talk about the relationship between despondency and sloth. I thought it was particularly interesting that you brought up Kathleen Norris's observation that we appear to be anything but slothful, and yet that is exactly what we are. We do more, we care less, we feel pressured to do still more. So it seems like there's this paradox going on. We're busy, and in our busyness, actually slothful.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And you even see this all the way, I keep harping on Evagrius just because I find his writing so perceptive, but even in the way that he talks about despondency, he talks about some monks who in despondency were lethargic, and despondency kind of slowed them down to where they would sleep excessively, eat excessively, and just kind of sit and mope around and slow way down. But then other monks in their despondency would be up and about, visiting other monks, walking all over the place, and just doing kind of busybody tasks. And so there's these two sides of the coin. And I think many of us today fall into the latter category. We live in a society that praises accomplishment, and that often is supposed to look like being very busy. And, you know, I'm a freelancer, so I always am hearing about the importance of hustle. You've always got to hustle and get as much content out there and get your name out there and do all of the things. But when you really step back from that, you realize that, gosh, I'm doing a lot, but does any of this really have meaning? And to what extent are all of these busy activities covering up an internal sense of purposelessness, of despair even? And I think that part of growing in our faith is taking a look at that inner despair and that inner loneliness that we try to cover up with busyness.
I want to also talk about your contention, and I think correctly so, that sin is a spiritual sickness. And if that is in fact the case, then the place for healing has to be the church. And there's a necessity then within the context of the church to partake of sacraments, the sacrament of confession, healing, the Eucharist, which all serves to reunite us to God and to be the balm of Gilead, the healing balm for the sickness that we have.
Yeah, this is something else that you often hear in Orthodoxy, that the church isn't a courtroom, it's a hospital. And so, you know, like any hospital, we're called to come there when we're sick, and we're all sick. We're all sick with something. And the means of healing in the church, it's not just a feel-good feeling that we get when we go to church and that's our healing. We do believe that the sacraments are given to us for the sake of healing and for the sake of restoration. And, you know, to kind of circle back to the idea that you brought up earlier in our conversation about the process and the goal. You know, as Christians, we go to church and we enter the church time after time after time after time. And if you're Orthodox or if you're a Christian in another kind of liturgical tradition, you often are praying the same prayers over and over again. In Orthodoxy, we pray, Lord, have mercy, all the time in the church. You'll pray that thousands and thousands of times over the course of your life. And from maybe a modern perspective, that would look like overkill, that would look like repetition. But the reason that we return to the church, the reason that we return to the sacrament, the Eucharist, every week minimum, is because we need these things in time. And every moment in time is a little bit different. Our lives have changed. I come to church one Sunday and then I come the next Sunday. My life has changed in between. Even if nothing major has happened, my life has changed. I'm moving forward in that life, and I return to Christ continually because I cannot enact healing in myself over time.
Stay with us. In just a few moments, we'll rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with historian Nicole Rokas. A fear of death and anxiety drive us out of the present moment and cause us to neglect the opportunity for true fellowship with the Lord Jesus today. Time and Despondency, Regaining the Present in Faith and Life by Dr. Nicole Rokas, offers insight into how to recapture the sacredness of time and re-encounter the resurrection of Christ in the dark and restless moments of our lives. To receive your copy of Time and Despondency, Regaining the Present in Faith and Life, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI, or visit us online at equip.org. The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. The Christian Research Journal's primary commitment is to contend earnestly for the faith that was once for all delivered to the saints. In keeping with this commitment, the journal's mission is both evangelistic and pastoral, furthering the proclamation and defense of the historic gospel of Jesus Christ, and helping his followers distinguish between essential Christian doctrine and doctrine that is peripheral, aberrant, or heretical. In an age of subjectivism and moral relativism, may Christians ground their faith and values in the objective, reliable testimony of Holy Scripture. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today. Call 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. A deeper understanding of the Bible's principles and truths will improve the spiritual, moral, and ethical problems facing our nation. Yet the obstacle isn't that the Bible doesn't speak to our greatest needs or answer our deepest questions. It's that the average person lacks the time and tools to extract the answers. That's why Hank Hanegraaff wrote the complete Bible Answer Book Collector's Edition, revised and updated. This expanded edition addresses over 210 of the top questions he's received as host of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Hank has taken the complex and made it simple and memorable. Receive the revised and updated complete Bible Answer Book as our thank you for your gift by calling 888-7000-CRI. And make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. That's equip.org. Anyone who's been paying attention knows there's a war going on, not just on traditional morality, civility, and decency, but even more fundamentally on historic notions of truth. And the enemy isn't just the onslaught of fake news facilitated by a post-truth culture and turbocharged by growing legions of ideological spin doctors. No, the real enemies of truth range from postmodernist convictions that there is no objective truth to militant scientism that claims that only science can determine truth, and religion is little more than primitive superstitions. But CRI support team members are not waving a white flag of surrender. They're holding the fort by undergirding every one of Christian Research Institute's mind-shaping and life-changing outreaches 24/7. To learn how you can make a difference and enjoy all the benefits of support team membership, simply visit equip.org. www.thecristianreach.org. Welcome back to a special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. Let's rejoin Hank and Dr. Nicole Rokas in their conversation.
Speaking about time, I wanted to circle back to time anyway. I think time is mysterious. It is a paradox. On the one hand, you think, wow, time is rushing by so quickly. On the other hand, time can seem very, very slow. Time can be a burden. Time can be a blessing. So there are paradoxical aspects of time that make it mysterious. And I think you did a very good job of cashing out the concept of time in the book Time and Despondency. And I'd love you to do that further for people listening in.
Yeah. So I sort of parse time out in three different ways. And one of them is what I call a Christological view of time. And that concerns the relationship between time and eternity, which, you know, prior to Christianity, if you look at like Hellenistic philosophy, time and eternity were understood to be largely dichotomous and antithetical to one another. Eternity was the world of forms and abstraction, and time was inferior because it was associated with change and mutability. And in, you know, Judaism, sort of contrary to this, even in ancient Judaism, you had this appreciation for the reality of God being active and present in time. If you look back at the events in the Old Testament, what you see is a God who was not above interacting in the world of time to reveal his salvation and his covenant to the people of Israel, whether it was saving the Hebrews from the Egyptians, whether it was showing himself to Moses in the form of a burning bush, whether it was giving his people the law. God was sort of intimately involved in the time and history of his people. And this continues into Christianity when Christians believe that Christ entered the world of time as the Son of God. And in that sense, forever changed the relationship between time and eternity, because now it's not just that eternity is somewhere out there and beyond us, it's fused with time through Christ. And that's something I think that we often lose sight of in our faith. We still, even as Christians, are sort of tempted to think about eternity as the place that we'll go when we die after this life. And that's actually in some ways problematic in view of the incarnation and especially the resurrection. So I think, like, if you look at liturgical traditions within Christianity, one of the things that you find is that people view liturgy as a sort of transfiguration of time. St. Basil talks about time being a pattern of eternity, and then sin kind of broke this pattern. But in liturgy, we get to go back and sort of repattern time on the basis of eternity. And that provides us this sort of experiential reminder that Christ, who is eternal, is also in our midst in time.
I think it's interesting, the part of the book where you talk about how, with respect to the resurrection, you experienced resurrection in, I guess, some kind of a liturgical church, but the reenactment of resurrection. And in the book, you talk about the difference between reenacting something that is historical and recognizing that the resurrection is present. You're experiencing the resurrection today, resurrection power, the reality of resurrection. So it's not merely a historical event, although it was historical and evidential, but it's something that we can experience in the present.
Yeah. In the book, I talk about how one of the main drivers of my own despondency and sort of despair in my faith was a sort of lifelong sense that everything I was learning about Christ was always at a distance. And I grew up Protestant. I grew up in a few different non-denominational churches. And the way that we would talk about the resurrection was always as this historical event, to the point where we would have sort of Easter, like passion plays that we would watch in our church. And I always felt in watching those passion plays that they were kind of the spiritual equivalent of a Civil War reenactment, that they were supposed to make what happened in the Last Supper and what happened to Christ on the cross real and living to me, but they actually had the opposite effect. And so I always felt like, oh gosh, that was 2,000 years ago. What does that really mean for me today? And so as a little kid, I thought, well, maybe if I were an actor in one of those plays, I would finally get it. And eventually I got to be on stage during one of those plays. And it was the same thing. I still felt like all of these things were at a distance and somehow had nothing to do with me. Not in the sense that Christ didn't have anything to do with me, but in the sense of, why is it that the whole shape of our faith is always looking backwards on this event? When in the New Testament, St. Paul says, today is the day of salvation. So why don't we talk about this in the present tense? And then I came to the Orthodox Church, and it was in the present tense. You always hear liturgically this refrain of Christ being risen. But more than that, the whole shape of liturgical worship brings the resurrection of Christ into the present moment constantly. And it brings ourselves with all of our baggage and all of our inner thoughts and turmoil and struggles. It brings all of us also into that present moment so that we can encounter Christ. And what I'm talking about is it's more than just a doctrinal statement. This is a whole experience of worship, of experiencing the living Christ unfolding in time through the liturgy.
I want to talk a little bit about two words that sort of drop off our tongue sometimes, but people may not know exactly what we're talking about. Chronos on the one hand, or the clock, and kairos, or purpose in time, on the other hand. Maybe you can cash that out for people listening in so they can kind of get the idea between chronos and kairos.
Yeah, so these are two terms for time that you find in the New Testament, and then consequently they have been appropriated in other theological contexts. Chronos in Greek is the term for chronological time. Actually, we get our word chronological from chronos. And this is what time does when it's just left to its own devices. If everyone in this world was in a coma, time ostensibly would continue to flow in days, months, weeks, that kind of thing. Kairos, in Greek, kairos, on the other hand, is the time of opportunity, the time of God's interruption in this world for salvific purposes. And definitely we have the more global kairos moments, the incarnation, the resurrection, the burning bush in the Old Testament, many other examples in the Old Testament, where we can kind of look back on salvific history and sort of chart the course of salvation through humankind and through earthly time, through chronos. But I think also in our own lives, we can look back on times when we knew that God was in this place, when we knew that God was interacting in our lives and in a certain way that may not even be evident to anyone else. I think it's important just on a personal level to remember those times in our lives because they don't happen very often and they're gifts from God. There's also another element of time that I think is worth bringing up. It often doesn't make it into the sort of chronos kairos distinction, and it's eon. We talk in the liturgy about blessed be our God now and ever and unto ages of ages. This word for ages or eons is another really important concept of time in biblical discussions as well as in patristic discussions. And this is the time of eons and the time of like redemptive cycles. If you think of the redemptive cycle of the Jubilee years in the Old Testament, that had an eonic quality to it. If you think of the four seasons of the year always returning back to spring and rebirth, that is also an eonic element of time. And I've already mentioned St. Basil when he's talking about the creation of the world. He says that in the beginning, time had an eonic quality because all of time had emerged from eternity and was returning back to eternity. And so those are three really important modes of time that I think are worth remembering in kind of Christian mentalities.
Something that we talked about a little earlier, but I think bears some redundancy or emphasis, is this notion that at the epicenter of our splintered relationship to time, there lies a rejection of the present moment. And so we have a despondency which signals an escape from the gift of God's ongoing self-revelation. And I think this fits in with what you're talking about with respect to the bifurcation of time, where when sin enters the world, when we have this sickness of sin in the world, our experience of time is shattered. It becomes bifurcated, where there's a continuum that is in reality part of a Christian worldview, as opposed to this bifurcation that is in the consciousness of so many people. So, for example, my mother died. We think of my mother as being in some other time-space continuum, altogether other, but the truth of the matter is the vapor, thin barrier between this world and the next world has been shattered through the resurrection. So if we have a proper concept of resurrection, we can experience relationship with those who have gone on before us.
Well, we've run out of time for today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Be sure to tune in again next time when we'll continue Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with historian Nicole Rokas. In appreciation for your gift to help strengthen and expand the life-changing outreaches of the Christian Research Institute, Hank would like to send you Dr. Nicole Rokas's book, Time and Despondency, Regaining the Present in Faith and Life. Simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI, or visit equip.org. That's equip.org. You can also write CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded solely by listeners like you. We're on the air because life and truth matter. The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. The Christian Research Journal's primary commitment is to contend earnestly for the faith that was once for all delivered to the saints. In keeping with this commitment, the journal's mission is both evangelistic and pastoral, furthering the proclamation and defense of the historic gospel of Jesus Christ, and helping his followers distinguish between essential Christian doctrine and doctrine that is peripheral, aberrant, or heretical. In an age of subjectivism and moral relativism, may Christians ground their faith and values in the objective, reliable testimony of Holy Scripture. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today. Call 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org.